Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg. Thanks so much for joining me for the Songs of Note podcast. I am pretty pumped today to be talking with Andrew McMahon. So if you know the name Andrew McMahon, you may know that he's been part of three killer bands, or maybe you don't. So let me tell you, Something Corporate, he's the lead singer of that band. Jax Mannequin, oh, I love them. He's the lead singer of that band. And now his latest project is Andrew McMahon in the Wilderness. I mean, this guy is a songwriting just guru. He's not a guru. He's just awesome. He's just an awesome songwriter. And I just really enjoyed getting to chat with him. He was kind enough to take my questions about his past. So like in case some of you guys don't know some of his past, I really wanted to be able to introduce and say, well, here's kind of where he came from. And then he battled leukemia along the way and overcame that. And then now he's married with a kid, and he talks about the story behind writing a song called Cecilia on the Satellite, which is just a fantastic song. In that's his daughter's name in the title. And then we end the interview with him calling me an a-hole because of the position I put him in, making him choose between two of his favorite bands, which was really funny and sort of the highlight. So if you're listening, thanks for listening to this show. The Songs of Note podcast is focused on the stories behind bands and songs and albums and just music that I like and hopefully that you guys like too. So if you're enjoying the show or if it's your first time here, be sure and subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And now let's head on over to the interview. This is Andrew McMahon. Hey, this is Ryan. Man, I'm so excited to be talking to Andrew McMahon. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the show to join me today.
Yeah, glad to be here, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. We were just talking about how I'm in Texas and you're in California, I believe, and you started the day with some surfing. I'm jealous of that. It's a little hot here.
Yeah, it's been my sort of like COVID breakthroughs. I've had so many days to be in the water that I've just gotten hooked. So I try to get out there a few times a week.
Man, that's a great move. Well, that was going to be my first question for you is like, let's look at just the past year. I know everybody's ready to move on from the past year, but I'm curious, for somebody who is used to performing in front of a lot of people, doing songs and just being around, I would assume a lot of people perform and stuff. How has the past year been just being at home? I assume you've been home with your family a lot. How's that going?
Obviously it's been a very strange year, I think, for all of us. I feel like, I've been really fortunate in the sense that it's given me something that I don't have most years, which is just an immense amount of time to be with my family, and I have a 7-year-old daughter. So, the silver lining for me was really just like getting to watch her grow. And she grew like 6 inches over the course of the year. So,
wow.
Obviously we could reflect on the negative, and there are a lot of people who obviously have been through so much. I'm lucky that I've been able to keep my house and keep the lights on, and I chose to spend the year, working on a project that had been kicking around for a long time that I never had the time for, and it gave me the ability to do that. So I really just did my best to steer into how I could make a positive out of it. And I was lucky that I got to.
Well, that's awesome. That was going to be my other question is like being at home and being surrounded by your family, were you still able to work on songs or was everybody like pulling their hair out and like, stop playing music? Was it?
If I'm being honest, Ryan, I took the year, mostly off of making music, and I worked on this memoir. I worked on a book project.
I saw you were doing that's awesome.
Yeah, so that was really where I put all of my energy. And I'm grateful for it because I think connecting now in the past couple of weeks, honestly, just since like I finally got fully vaccinated, and the rest of the world up here in the studio world is starting to do the same. So we're finally being able to like get into rooms together and create again. Mm-hmm. But I think so much of that wasn't really happening in the traditional sense, you know, that we're like, for me, I like to be in a shared space, you know, like that's how I, you know, collaborating works for me. And, you know, these ideas of like Zoom writing sessions and production sessions just like did not appeal to me. So having the discipline of, you know, sort of forcing myself to sit in a chair, you know, for, you know, 6 to 8 hours a day and just write and investigate these memories and try and kind of piece together, you know, some, you know, history and how it's impacted my life. It was a really good exercise for me. And I think kept me from spending most of my day cocktailing, which I probably would have been doing if I didn't have something to work on, you know?
Totally. Well, you know, I can't remember the quote, but it's basically the unobserved life is not worth living is something that came to mind. And so looking back, I feel like is always helpful. If you're up for it, I would love to ask you a couple questions about your past and then into your future. Sure. You know, I always like being able to ask about, you know, your first introduction to an instrument. And, if I am getting my facts right, you taught yourself how to play piano, but it was based around your uncle passing away. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. I mean, my family has always, you know, had music in the house, whether it was the family piano in the living room or, just the fact that I had four older brothers and sisters, you know, three of which were, you know, teenagers when I was, you know, 5, 6 years old. And so there was always, you know, whatever the newest music was coming down the pipe, I was in speakers being blasted out of bedrooms in my house. And so early on, I mean, I always tinkered on the piano, even from the time I was probably 3, 4 years old. But just in the same way most kids might, you know, just banging on the thing. I got probably 3 or 4 piano lessons when I was, you know, 6, 7 years old. And it did not make sense to me. I kind of remember being sort of bummed out because I really loved the piano and I just could not, I couldn't make sense of reading music and all that. It didn't really resonate with me. And then, when I was 9, my family, moved to Pasadena right around the same time. An uncle who we were all very close with, had passed away from skin cancer. And, it coincided with this sort of serendipitous moment. One of my first friends in the 4th grade, his dad was in a bar band and taught the two of us how to play, you know, the 12 bar blues and, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis's Whole Lot of Shaking going on.
Nice. The
first song I learned on the piano, just that little, you know, that bass line walk, yeah. You know, walk up the piano. And I remember coming home from that day, from that very piano lesson. And I'd always written poetry as a kid. And as my uncle was sort of passing, I found myself really steering towards the written word. And so I was a very like kind of emotional, nerdy kid who didn't play sports. And, you know, just it was a little bit more of like the artist than my older brothers and sisters who were all athletes. And having learned those chords that day, I sat down at the piano, you know, finally being able to understand something about it. And I just basically took my hands and moved them around the piano. You know, just that simple triad chord. I just played it on the white keys until I found enough places that it sounded good and started writing my first song.
That's a cool combination to start the instrument and start writing your first song, like, you know, in conjunction together. I think that's a neat, I would say that I wonder if that's common for a lot of people, but I think that's a unique thing. Looking back at like something corporate, and I mean, you guys were so young when that actually took off, but I imagine you must have had a certain level of confidence to even approach anybody, like at your school, a musician saying, "Hey, do you want to join a band?" So, do you remember some kind of affirmation, like from people saying, "Hey, you've got a great voice," or "Hey, that's a good song"? Like, is there some kind of moment you remember about having that giving you confidence to be able to approach people about doing a band?
You know, it's interesting. I feel like my confidence and self-consciousness run on kind of opposite tracks. You know, I I was anything but a confident kid. But I also, you know, will say that, you know, playing for me and writing music for me, especially from such a young age, was sort of so wrapped up in my identity. And it was also, it was the one thing that really made sense to me, you know? And so even in the million other ways that I was incredibly insecure, behind the keys of a piano is the one place that I felt truly in command of something. And not in a way that I would say it was a confidence as much as it was just a feeling or a sense of being at home there. I think really where the Something Corporate story begins kind of with the first band that I started in high school, which had two other members. Two of the founding members of Something Corporate were in this band as well. And a lot of it lined up with, yes, I mean, I made it through freshman year, which was like a very awkward year. You know, I was a heavy set kid for a lot of years, and I kind of grew up, you know, I kind of got a little taller, and all of a sudden, you know, I got a girlfriend, and, you know, and things started coming together, I think, over that, like that summer going into my sophomore year. And I had been kind of using the high school theater as my avenue for performance, because I loved to perform, but really just found myself not fulfilled there. But at the same time, I was always writing songs and playing the songs for the kids that I was in theater class with and for my friends. And a battle of the bands popped up my sophomore year of high school. And so it was kind of hysterical, really. Like, the way I built the band was just, there were these kids. I was always like, you know, I always kind of gravitated towards the older kids in my classes, which, you know, generally meant that they were kids who were like retaking a class because they were slackers, you know. And like Brian, I remember my drummer, who was just the greatest soul, one of my dear friends to this very day. I had heard him talking at Christmas saying that he got a drum kit for Christmas. And Brian was a popular kid and a lot cooler than I was. And I remember thinking when I was building that band, I was like, this is a battle of the bands. Like, I should probably try and get some kids that are cooler than me to join my band, you know? And so I asked Brian, because he was like the coolest kid I knew, and he was older than me by a grade or two. And I knew he had a drum set, like, but it didn't deter me in any shape or form that he had just gotten that drum set and never played drums before. And that's kind of what I did. I mean, I just kind of kept my ear out for people I knew who played instruments, and I just pieced it together over a couple of weeks. Brian brought in one of his buddies who was a guitar player, and I knew Kevin, who became Clutch from Something Corporate. I knew him from drama class, and I worked with the other guitar player at my mom's hotel. You know, it's just like just a silly kind of thing, and we practiced four or five times. And set up and like won our high school battle of the bands, you know, but we weren't really any good. And we sort of broke up right after we won the battle of the bands. Cause it was, you know, it was cool, but I don't think it was like satisfying probably for anybody. Yeah. And then finally the following year, who, you know, is the co-founder of Something Corporate and also a really great songwriter who wrote music and wrote songs for the band as well. And that was when I got really serious. And that was like my junior year of high school.
Do you remember, for me, like the music that I heard like in junior high and high school was like, I mean, it's still the music that resonates most strongly for me. I'm curious if that's true for you. And if so, what are those bands that still are, you know, mean the most to you?
Well, I mean, yeah, of course. Like the stuff that you pick up when you're first getting into music is, you know, somehow like just baked into your DNA. And for me, those bands were, were like the Counting Crows, Weezer, Ben Folds Five, Travis, Drag, Semisonic. Like I'm trying to think of, you know, there. Yeah, I mean, it was pretty much kind of any of that like left leaning pop was kind of really what I gravitated towards. And you know, Radiohead was like, were gods. Like, you know, when I started smoking pot in school, it was like I discovered OK Computer the same day. It was like, holy shit, you know. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, those were really, they were sort of like the seminal acts for me that, you know, I started going to see shows, and those were the shows that my friends and I were, you know, lining up, you know, at noon at you know, the El Rey or, you know, the Troubadour or whatever. Jimmy World was huge for me back then. You know, we got like, there was like, you know, living down in Orange County, like the punk scene was really big down here. And I sort of found myself gravitating towards like the other side of that, like the early, what I think people began calling emo, like, you know, Jimmy World and the Get Up Kids, and like,
Yellow Card,
you know? Yeah. I mean, it was, for me, those were like, you know, I think Yellow Card kind of came almost after something. Or around the same time, we all sort of emerged in a similar scene. But what I was like listening to as Something Corporate was getting started, were those bands like Third Eye Blind kind of right before alternative radio became like Limp Bizkit and Puddle of Mud and kind of like
silly.
Stained and like all the new metal stuff. It was like right before any of that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Alanis Morissette was still getting played on like alternative radio, No Doubt, and stuff like that.
We are like right in the same age time frame then, because those are all the bands that hit for me. When I first got into you and your music, it was, I missed most of the Something Corporate, but I got in at Jack's Mannequin. It just was all in. And that album is, I played it in the past week and just rocking out. It's still so good. I wonder if you'd be willing to talk about that a little bit as far as, man, I would think you can't separate that from getting sick, with leukemia.
Yeah.
Growing up, my next door neighbor passed away from leukemia as a kid. So it was just totally unexpected. And I can't imagine, what was your reaction when you found out you had this thing? Were you angry? Were you sad? Were you just ready to fight it?
It's a really interesting, it's an interesting thing to sort of relive and think about, because, you know, for me, no, I was not angry when I got sick, I think, you know, you referenced Everything in Transit. So much of the sort of span of a year or so that surrounded that record and the creation of it and sort of the tumult of separating from Something Corporate, but the freedom that brought to me, and then also like the ability to do what for me I really felt like for the first time was to like really be able to explore both my songwriting and production in the studio in a way that really I just found so satisfying. You know, there was like, the Something Corporate story isn't one of like massive amounts of tension or infighting or whatever. We loved each other. But you know, we stopped getting along the way we used to, I guess would be the best way to describe it. Right. And so I think we all saw that coming, and rather than become this band that, you know, that hated each other, we sort of pumped the brakes for a minute and decided like, let's go do some other things and see what that does for us. You know, we didn't even really officially break up. And the year leading up to my diagnosis, you know, was this incredible and kind of heartbreaking and beautiful year. You know, I was broken up with my girlfriend, who's now my wife. And, you know, I was just sort of like free to just explore the world, you know, after having spent so many years in a tour bus on top of, you know, so many people. You know, I was like, I was, you know, really kind of like floating on a breeze, and everything that happened that year felt so sort of faded and intentional. And it led me to that record, which I still is one of my favorites that I've made to this day. Hmm. And so when I found out that I was sick, and at the timing, all of it was like so strange, you know, the band name Jack's Mannequin, I named it after a friend of mine who was a leukemia survivor. You know, I was diagnosed or at least was sent to the hospital on the very day that I finished the album. You know, in the weeks leading up to the record, I had, you know, started to reconcile with my girlfriend, and all these things seemed to be coming together. So when I found out I was sick, you know, I know it sounds a little bizarre as a reaction, and maybe it was just shock, but I remember thinking, like, whatever this is somehow meant to be a part of this journey for me. And, you know, and I made peace with it very quickly. You know, I'll admit it's later, you know, it was in my recovery as a survivor, and in the years on the other side of being sick, that some of that tension and feelings of alienation and anger, those things started cropping up later for me. But in the midst of the disease itself, I was really resolute to just figure it out and get to the other side.
Man, that's interesting. I can't imagine stepping into that. And that's cool in the fact that you say that you were able to say, this is going to be part of my story. And I love the work that you've done, to help other people who have had that. I read a quote, and I wonder if you would be willing to talk about it a little bit. You said, if I'm quoting you right, you said, "I spent my 20s figuring out how to get out from underneath this horrible disease. You start by getting your body better, but nobody prepares you for what it does to your mind." What did you mean by that?
Well, being young and very sick is a really complicated thing. But I think there was this whole second wave of it for me that I just was completely unprepared for. I think, you know, you would assume that, and it's fair to assume, you know, you're going to go through this disease that, you know, at least on a handful of occasions felt like it was, you know, very close to taking my life. And that was a very real possibility. Mm. There was so much that could go wrong that went right. I think my assumption was that I would get to the other side of it and everything would go back to normal, you know, and that I would be well, and I would be able to go back to making music like I'd made music, and life would continue. And it was just a lot more complicated than that for me. It shook my confidence in such a major way. I think, you know, the time that I was diagnosed, I would argue, was probably the most confident I've been in my life. I was, you know, I had one successful band and was completely unafraid to blow that whole thing up and start another one, which is like, many people would have thought that I was insane to do that, or did think I was insane to do that. I think the period of my life that I was in, I was about as fearless and young and hungry and able as I'd ever been. And when I returned to the world, you know, what it had done to shake my confidence was so massive. It became really difficult to write. Every decision felt like a life or death decision, you know. I understand it now to be, you know, post-traumatic stress. I was dealing with a lot of depression and a lot of fear attached to whether the disease would come back again or not. I got married in the middle of it, and that put a tremendous strain on, you know, my relationship. I definitely, without question, I tried really hard to reclaim the life that I had before I was sick, and I had a really hard time accepting that perhaps life was just going to be different for me afterwards, you know? And it took me a lot of years to figure that out. You know, it was a process. It was a real process. And I should have sought counseling for early on, you know, so I can, you know, just to have anybody to tell me, like, hey, this is normal, you're going to make it through this. But I didn't, you know, and instead I drank and smoked and partied my way through it and tried to, you know, try to be 22 all over again, you know, right. And it was really hard. It was hard, especially hard on my wife. And, you know, but I will say, you know, it happened, and it's informed why we built the foundation the way we built it. Because what I found out years later was that so many young people go through the same troubled reentry. And you know, I learned a lot about myself, and I'm happy to say that it's been years since I've been in that headspace, you know, and I finally sought help and have spent, you know, the last several years, you know, just figuring my shit out. And doing so, it led to, you know, the birth of, you know, this new project and a much more collaborative version of my career and a much happier day-to-day existence than I was living before I made those realizations.
Well, thanks for being, thanks for being willing to answer that. I know that's heavy stuff. I want to talk about, I love your current project. I think you guys have such a cool sound, and it sounds like a band. It feels like a band, but so different from your other work. And I'm curious on, I love hearing the stories behind songs. I wonder, so a two-part question is, Cecilia, is your daughter named after the Simon and Garfunkel song? And two, would you mind telling the story about writing the song Cecilia and the Satellite?
Yeah, absolutely. So, no, she's not named after the Simon and Garfunkel song. She's actually named after my wife's aunt, who was an amazing lady. She passed shortly after Cecilia was born, but Cecilia was named for her, and she also has a great aunt, Cecilia. So it's a family name on my wife's side, and it also turns out that Cecilia is the patron saint of music, which I thought was a nice little addition to that that story. So the story of writing Cecilia and the Satellite is, you know, it starts in a similar fashion to a lot of the writing process on the first Wilderness album, which, you know, it, hysterically, you do these things, I call them blind dates, but when you're sort of writing collaboratively, a lot of times you end up kind of getting thrown into rooms with people you've never met, and you try and make a song together. Mm. And this was something that was a very new process for me, and something I was learning how to do over the course of, you know, the year or two leading up to the creation of the album. On the particular day that Cecilia and the Satellite was started, I was introduced to a young British producer, a guy named James Flanagan, and his writing partner, a Swede, I believe, named Anders Graham. And the two of them were just these like hungry, awesome kind of producer writers. We ended up in this little room in the basement of like a Hollywood high rise building where I'd gotten kind of used to. My publisher always sent me there to work. I was like, I think my wife was maybe 2-3 weeks from her due date. I had kind of come into the session, and I'd let the guys know, because I live an hour and a half away from LA. I'd let these guys know, like, hey, just so you know, we're within striking distance of this baby being born. And I, you know, I'm coming. I want to do the session, but anything could happen, you know. And up to that point, I had more or less resisted the temptation to dig too deeply into the fatherhood concept. You know, I felt like it might be like a corny adventure to embark on. And so I hadn't, but I got into the studio that day, and I remember James just saying, well, obviously we need to write about you becoming a father. And I was like, oh man, we can't do that. Sure enough, so we sort of tabled it for a second and just started screwing around. And the first thing that happened was he put up just a kind of a simple version of that beat, that sort of almost like water droplets that you hear throughout the track. These sort of percussive kind of ballady, almost bell kind of things that you'll hear in the background. It's an arpeggiating thing. Mm-hmm. He had that idea going, and I sat down at a keyboard with just a kind of a cheesy, like, string patch, almost like a Juno Rush kind of synth pad, and played that F to C combination that you hear right at the top of the song, just the boom, boom. And for whatever reason, two chords never sound better to me, you know. And And we all knew right away. And I think he might have come up with that very first line, you know, "I locked myself in a hotel room" or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I remember just going and thinking to myself, I might be able to write this version of fatherhood. You know, I had obviously come out of I had lived many, many lives leading up to the decision that I was responsible enough human to have a child. And and so we started in on the idea of the song as almost an investigation of these sort of all the beauty and tragedy of life that you live before you bring another person into the world. And and so it really became, for the whole day, it became, you know, what stories are you going to tell this kid, right? And what does that mean? And so that opened up all of these experiences, you know, and it really became a lyrical adventure more than anything at first. You know, we had that melody, we were just like, let's just stick with that. Let's not deviate from this melody. Let's just plug as many experiences into it as we can. And it came very quickly for me. You know, I found myself, venturing into all these memories that defined my life up to that point. And it was kind of this cool little triptych of experiences, that I realized that I was kind of going to impart to my kid. And so that was, you know, the story of being young and getting this car crash with my mom, or, you know, going on tour with my band for the first time. And we wrote the verses. The chorus was really hard. And we got to the chorus that day. But it was a different version of the chorus at first. The song was initially called "If I Could Fly." There was no mention of Cecilia in the song for an entire month until well after she was born. We were back in the studio, and so the original chorus was, "If I could fly, then I would know what life looks like from up above and down below. I'd keep you safe, I'd keep you dry, and I'd light every step you take if I could fly." Like a decidedly more kind of corny ending to that song, but at the time it felt good. You know, we're like, it sounds amazing. And sort of right as we made it through the chorus and had these two verses done, I get a call from my wife, and she says, "I'm not sure, but I feel like I might be having some contractions." And we had kind of just caught fire. We're like, "Oh my gosh, we're putting this thing together." And I mean, admittedly, I don't recommend this for anybody. She didn't hang me up about it at all, but I was like, "Well, so should I come home?" she was like, "Look, I don't really know if they are. Why don't I just hang for a minute and I'll check back in with you?" And I was like, I should have just gotten in the car and gone. Luckily, she did not have the baby that night, and I didn't suffer from my decision to stay and keep working. But I think we knew in the session that it was special. You know, there was just something. The aesthetic of the song came together so quickly, and it just sounded big. You know, and so I came home, and I actually sat down at the piano in my garage the next day. And that's when I wrote those pre-choruses, for all the things my hands have held, for all, you know, those little buttons that come in right before each chorus.
Yeah.
And it's when I wrote the lead line that follows the chorus, the da 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 da. And that was originally just a piano part.
Oh, that's cool.
A few days pass, and we're so excited about the song that I called James, and I was like, "We've got to finish this thing like before the baby comes, you know, like let's do this." And so I ran up to the studio. He was like living in the back house of like some wealthy guy, like that, like, you know, had been like a fan of his production and like let him, like it was hysterical. Wow. I'm like, "Whose mansion are you spending the night?" You know what I mean? And he had a studio in the back, and I'm like, "Yo, you got cooler friends than I do," you know? And we recorded a piano, we recorded the lead line, the new the new pre-chorus and everything. It was still If I Could Fly at that point. Forgive me for droning on, but I figure if you want the whole story, I'll just give the whole thing to
that's
you.
That's great.
You can cut it up if you need.
That's awesome. I love it. I love it.
Yes. Yeah, so I did it. So we finished the song and we think, okay, we have a masterpiece. It's done. And we really did feel like this was something special, you know? And I sent it to my manager, Jonathan, who is, he's kind of like just the, he's just the greatest song guy out there. It's one of the reasons I went to work with my management team was because I just trusted his gut. I sent it to him and he sends me this note back, which I was like, I didn't know how to receive it because it said, do you think this is the best song you've ever written? Right. Or he said something like that.
Wow.
You know? And I was like, but I couldn't tell if he was like, you know, if my excitement for the song, and he was just kind of like, I didn't know if he was kind of going like, really, you know, if he thought that there was something special about it too. And we got on a call and he was like, I think there's something great about this. And he was really excited about it. So fast forward, like, you know, now I'm in baby land, the baby comes, and I shut down everything for a month to just kind of be in that world. I finished a lot of music for the record, a lot of the writing, decided to bring James on to help co-produce the record with me and Mike Viola, who I'd done other writing for the record with. And we started working in a studio in Sunset called Husk, this really funny studio with this hysterical dude named Elton, who ran it, who we were pretty sure named himself after Elton John. Like, we couldn't quite figure it out, like, but he was a great guy, and he was just so sweet. And we were working out of one of his rooms there. And I get a call from my other manager, Bob. And now Bob is like the muscle of the two sort of heads of my management team. And I love Bob, but he was also the reason I almost didn't go to work with them because I was so terrified of him, like in the years leading up to our working together. And Bob calls me on the phone. He's like, you know, Andrew, you know, I'll always talk in an exaggerated New York accent. I don't even know if he has one, but I always pretend that he does. And he's like, this song, If I Could Fly, you know, like, he's like, it's great. But of course, my phone is ringing right here. It's a great song. But If I Could Fly, like, I think there's a Disney song called If I Could Fly. Or so, you know, he said something like that to me, and I was just like, dashing my hopes. You know what I mean? I'm like, here, I feel like we've got this like masterpiece, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm kind of angry, you know, but God bless him, because he was willing to tell me the truth. And I really am fortunate to have people who are around me who don't just tell me yes when I want them to, you know? And the last thing he said, and I had to kind of hang up because I was kind of so mad about it. The last thing he said to me is like, what do you like, put a girl's name in it or something?
Wow, that's great. That's, man, that's awesome.
And I hang up the phone and I'm so mad. I was driving to the studio when it happened. And I was so pissed off. And I get to the studio and I look at James and I'm like, you're not going to believe the conversation I had. But, you know, after I let the conversation simmer, I was just like, well, duh, the whole song is about my daughter.
Yeah.
Why don't you try and write her name into it?
That's cool.
And so that began literally what became, so we would work in the studio on the music we were making at the time. It was like the songs that were coming specifically out of the writing of those sessions, like Maps for the Getaway was written in that room. Mm-hmm. And then we were doing a lot of the production for the record. And so what would happen is we'd work all day, and then Mike would go home, and James and I would sit at the piano for hours until well into the morning. And we did this for, I want to say, 2 or 3 days, trying to figure out how to change the end of the chorus, make it still good. And it took us days to land on Don't Be Afraid, Cecilia, I'm the Satellite Near the Sky. I mean, it's never taken longer to write so few words in my life, but I think we knew that if we cracked the code, it would be, you know, it has potential to be something really important for both of us. You know, we were both, you know, I mean, I had been, you know, my career had obviously been going for some time, but we wanted to have a big song that established this project as, you know, as relevant. And you know, after having two bands and you know, entering my 30s and whatever, it was important that we had a really big song off this record and that I established myself outside of Jack Mannequin and something corporate. And I think, you know, James was a young writer at that point. It had some success, but, you know, we were both like, we were hungry for it. And then we finished it and sent it off, and Bob was very happy, you know, and so was Jonathan. And of course, I mean, from the production standpoint, we laced up that original piano hook with as many instruments and voices as we could, and worked with my buddy John Sinclair, Jake Sinclair, I should say, John's brother Jake, who mixed the record. He went through, and he's a great producer. He's done, you know, some massive albums, and he mixed the album and helped kind of push the production over the end at the 11th hour, just, you know, adding some additional live drums and just some cool things to pull it together. But yeah, man, it was, of all the songs I've ever written and worked on, it was a true labor of love. You know, most of it happened in a day, but everything else took every ounce of energy to make that song what it was.
Man, sure. I love it. That's what we do the show is hear about the song. So to hear from your mouth, like all the things that went into it, that's awesome. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, man, my pleasure.
I love that. Well, so I've got one more question, but if you need to go, I want to let you go. Do you have time or no?
No, I'm all yours, man.
Okay. I appreciate you being willing to take some serious questions, but I also just like doing like some fun, like quick fire questions. So I'd love to ask you a couple of, I'm going to like give you two artists, and I just want you to say from your gut, which one you would prefer. It doesn't have to mean that you love it more than the other one, but I'm just like, what comes to mind if I say it? So Elton John or Billy Joel?
I mean, I'm a Billy guy. I love Elton John, but Billy Joel, he was my idol. My very first concert I ever attended was a Billy Joel concert. He's the guy for me.
All right. Ben Folds or Rufus Wainwright?
Ben Folds. Love Ben Folds. He was my, many Ben Folds shows in my life. I love Ben.
Me too. He's great. Weezer, would you go Pinkerton or the Blue Album?
Oh, that is a heartbreaking question.
yes.
I'll go Blue Album, but I do so firmly stating my love for Pinkerton.
Same here. One album. You can only take one album on, like COVID shuts down and you're by yourself and you only have one album forever. Could you say what it would be?
Oh, Tom Petty, Wildflowers.
Oh, man. So good. Gosh.
Yeah.
That's a killer record. Beatles or Stones?
Beatles, probably. I mean, I'll go Beatles.
Pearl Jam or Nirvana?
I mean, as a kid who grew up in the grunge era, I know you're asking rapid fire, but of course I'm going to punt.
No, this is great.
I grew up in grunge, but I didn't get it because I was like the nerdy piano player kid while Nirvana was breaking, and I became a Nirvana fan along the way. But certainly in that moment, I was more of a Pearl Jam fan, and I continue to admire those guys and admire Eddie Vedder. So I'm going to go with Pearl Jam.
Love it. Radiohead or Counting Crows?
Oh, shut the fuck up. Come on, man. That is an unfair thing to do to me. I think I've established my love for both bands.
I tweaked it based on your initial comments.
What an asshole. I think I would just say because of the impact that Counting Crows had on me and my writing and my love of music, you know, they were really, truly the first band that was my own. You know what I mean?
Like, I do.
Like when I saw them on Saturday Night Live, I think I was in the sixth grade. All my music before that was like had been shown to me by my brothers and my sisters and my parents. And the Counting Crows was the first band I became a fan of.
Yeah.
Just because I stumbled into them. So I would say the Counting
Crows. Yeah. All right. Last one. What's a band you like that people wouldn't expect that you would be into? It could be anything from any time. Is there anything that comes to mind?
A band I like that people would, I mean, you know, this is gonna sound really, really funny. I mean, it's kind of timely because I'm doing a little work with the guitar player from this band. But I like grew up a Rage Against the Machine fan.
Okay.
I think most people would think it's a bit of a far fetched.
No.
When I was a kid, you know, when you're like a sophomore in high school, freshman in high school, and you don't have your license yet, right? And you like have that one friend who drives. You kind of have to listen to whatever they listen to.
Yep.
I'm gonna pick two bands for you in this time. They could not be more opposite. So one of my buddies that drove, his name was Bodger, and he listened like exclusively to They Might Be Giants. So
oh,
I became
nice.
A They Might Be Giants fan. And, you know, so that okay. was. That might be a little closer to my wheelhouse. But then my other buddy, Troy, he only listened to Rage Against the Machine and Chumbawamba. Okay, that's what I'm telling you that right now, honestly. And
that's great.
And so when you're given the choice between the two, and I have nothing against Chumbawamba, but I was like let's listen to Rage, which was so counter to everything I'd ever grown up listening to. I was thinking, listening to like James Taylor and Billy Joel and the Counting Crows. But at some point something clicked in me. I was like, this is amazing. You know, and it's like, kind of the first time I ever felt that, like, I want to like get physical when I'm listening to music, you know, like there's a headbang. It would seem pretty fair to say that would be one of the more, you know, something that maybe people would not assume I had grown up on or was into. But
I love it.
But it was.
Awesome. Well, Andrew, man, I appreciate your time. Appreciate you being willing to take random questions and then, you know, just go deep on some of your story. And I just really love your songwriting and your music and wish you the very best. In the coming year and in years to come.
Well, I appreciate it. It's great to talk to you and good luck to you with everything you're doing next.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.